For over 100 episodes of this show, I've sat behind my microphone and asked some of the biggest names in the Earhart world for answers to the questions that have been burning in my mind for all of my life. Never in a million years did I ever think the show could flip the format and pull off what we're about to do. Tonight, in a very different approach to our show, my good friends Sean Keats and Bri Kupfer make their Chasing Earhart debuts and turn the tables to interview me. I said nothing was off limits. What you're about to hear is something I never imagined would happen for this show. This is me, uncensored, for the most part. Enjoy.
Chasing Earhart. Don't adjust your dials. Don't relook to be sure you're on the right podcast, even if the voice sounds wrong. Tonight, we're doing something that has never been done here at Chasing Earhart in its over 100 previous episodes. I'm Bri Kupfer, he's Sean Keats. And tonight, on this episode of Chasing Earhart, we're here to interview Chris Williamson, the longtime host of this podcast, the co-host of the popular Vanished podcast, and the man recently featured on the History Channel's History's Greatest Mysteries. 6 years ago, the man we are about to interview launched the fantastic Chasing Earhart podcast, a podcast not afraid to investigate every theory about what happened to Earhart and Noonan and to give all of them equal consideration. I don't have to tell you how rare that is. So let's get right into it. Thanks for letting us flip the tables on you tonight, Chris. I'd like to start off this interview the same way you always do. Can you tell me a little bit about your background and education?
Sure. Yeah, that's an awesome introduction. Thank you so much. My background's mainly in IT. It has nothing to do with really the documentary side of things or anything. I've been doing IT for about 20 plus years. Got an associate's and I got a bachelor's and I just sort of stopped there and got a couple of certifications and just had like this kind of weird, long, winding road in a career in IT. That's basically it. That's my entire background. I've always been a history person, history guy, history fan, and Earhart has always been part of my life. So it just sort of rode that section of my life until I got to the point where I could sort of do something with it. And that's what led me to the project initially.
How did you first get interested in Amelia Earhart?
Yeah. So I tell this all the time, but it just started really, really early for me. Third grade, did a history day project on her, and I just kept coming back. Over the years, you know, the ideas became more complex and I sort of started experimenting with more theory and all that stuff in the case. And then I sort of birthed the project out of it. So, you know, Earhart has been with me for a very long time. And it's sort of not an uncommon story for people that have gotten involved in it, that have seen it way back young when they were little for the first time. Same here.
Yeah, I think most of us have always known about Earhart somehow or another. Now, I know my partner on this podcast tonight is chomping at the bit and ready to go. So Sean, take it away.
Thank you, Bri. So, Chris, we have permission to ask you anything that we want. Is that correct?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so if you went to Las Vegas and put your money down on the table and said, this is what I think happened to Amelia Earhart, where's your money going and what odds are you giving?
Tonight? I would say my odds are probably in Buca tonight.
Okay, Buca.
I would give the odds. I think the odds are good. I think the odds are good that he's got something there that is connected to Amelia Earhart in some way, shape, or form. I don't know how, I don't know why, but he's got something. I'm pretty convinced. And I'm saying that because I'm a little bit privy to some behind the scenes information that a lot of people don't know about. It's a project that has really gone very, very slowly, but I think Bill is made the right moves. You know, he's sort of been very methodical in the way he's approached the whole subject. And I think people are going to be shocked when they find out what is there. Now, I don't know if that means it's going to be Earhart's plane or if it's going to be something else entirely. I don't know the answers to that, but I think he's going to be a pretty popular guy pretty soon.
Okay. So define soon.
I'd say in the next year.
In the next year. Okay. So that's interesting because I did want to start off with the Buca hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And in order for Buca to work, you have to believe a certain number of things. And most importantly, you have to believe that she turned around about mid-flight and that the balance of her flight, I say her, but I really mean their flight.
Right, sure.
Even though signals were getting progressively stronger as she approached Howland, you're saying that she was actually going farther away. Hmm. That's attributable all to Skip. Is that correct?
Yeah, essentially, that's what they're saying. They're really saying that they don't know how it happened, that, you know, they don't fully know the story of how Earhart ended up at Buka. They don't know that. And I think Bill's been pretty open about expressing that. But they theorize that Skip has a lot to do with it. Initially, when they come on Vanished, I think that between Bill Snavely and Tracy Wildricks and everybody at Project Blue Angel that were a part of the show, I think they held up pretty well. You know, I think it makes sense that what they're positing, that, hey, Skip can have effect. We've talked to so many people that have said it happens. It happens all the time. And, you know, who am I to say it's impossible? I think what you're saying, though, as far as, you know, what you're getting at is, you know, obviously the distance from Howland Island. And I would argue that, you know, that's a valid, compelling argument against it, because he is, what, 1,700 miles away-ish from what I call ground zero. Personally, I have a big problem with that. He has to explain a lot of those questions. I think the ones that Jen really hit him with in the show. How do you explain S5, S5, S5? And that means mathematically 200 miles or less out. And how do you explain Nick and Mororo? How do you explain the Marshall Islands? How do you explain Buka? It just gets further and further out. So I agree that that's a difficult argument, you know, to overcome. But what if he's got the plane there, though?
Well, he does have the plane, and let's ask about that. Full disclosure, I have donated to Project Blue Angel. Not a lot, but I have.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because I find it interesting,
right,
the concept.
Right.
What he has, in theory, is a plane, and nobody's disputing that he has a plane, I should be clear.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, whose plane is it?
Right.
Will they actually retrieve the plane, or is there some other method afoot? And obviously, only tell us what you can tell us.
You know, I can tell you that Buka 3, the official, the third trip out there, they intend it to be their final trip. I can tell you that much. Bill has put in, you know, a lot of his own personal, you know, he's funded the first two expeditions on his own, with the exception of about $3,500 or so from GoFundMe. And he's, you know, very, very appreciative of that. And I know that he's going to be, matter of fact, we were just talking the other day, and he's wanting to release some of the footage from Buka 2 that no one's ever seen. And he's wanting to release it to the GoFundMe donors as a thank you for it, you know, first, before they release it publicly. So I know that that's coming. I know that they're really trying to ramp up sort of a third and final trip, without spoiling really any detail of what I've been privy enough to know. What I will tell you is that I've always dreamed of, and I've always been very vocal of, cross theory collaboration. I've yelled at the mountaintops for this for years, even when nobody else seemed to be doing it. And now I can tell you that with Buka 3, you know, we're finally going to get the very first ever cross theory collaboration for a major theory in the Earhart case. There are people from Japanese Capture. There are people from Castaway. There are people from Crash and Sink, legitimate names that are involved in trying to help Bill go out to Buka and put an end to this thing one way or another. That's kind of where we're at, and that's what they're efforting, and that's what Bill is championing personally. He wants to do it right. He wants to just put one final expedition together, and he wants his answer more than anyone else, and I think he's going to get it, and I think when he gets it, it's going to upset a major balance in sort of what history may or may not have written. I really believe he's got something. I don't know if he's got the plane, but he's got something that's really special there, and I can't wait for people to find out finally. It's been tough to sort of keep a lot of stuff quiet that you can't really talk about publicly.
So I've got a question that is tangential to it, but not specific. Do we know anything about any other logs that Bellertz was involved in? Because I know one of the things that Bill talks about is how he says KHAQQ to Itasca is going to be Bellertz shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
Do we find that anywhere in the other logs, or do we even have any other logs from him?
From Bellertz that I know of, no. I think there's one set of logs from Bellertz. That's the set that everybody's seen. That's really the Itasca's official logs. He was the chief radio man on the Itasca, so it would have been his official record of what happened that morning, at least from his point of view. There is some record of some of the other radio men in the room sort of copying and writing down their own versions of what they were hearing Earhart say at the time. And I know Bill sort of, he leans into something that, you know, again, maybe compelling, maybe worthless. One of the logs, they're writing S5, and then all of a sudden that second radio man starts writing S5 with a question mark. Like, it's maybe he's not sure if it's maybe going away a little bit, or if the signal's getting weaker, or maybe he's just jotting a question mark down so Leo can take a look at it. Who knows? Or maybe it's worthless altogether. But Bill does seem to lean into that a little bit, like to sort of show that, hey, maybe she was farther away and that the skip was actually starting to play a role, you know, that constant S5 strain. Again, I mean, him and and Tracy and Project Blue Angel, they make compelling enough arguments that it's, again, when you have it on everything else that they've got on top of that, it's you know, too compelling to ignore.
Bellarts couldn't have only served on one ship his entire career. That's why I'm curious if we have any other ones where maybe he said, for instance, hey, McGovern to the Colorado or something like that. So we know that he does that normally, or if it's just his shorthand.
No, that's his shorthand that I know of, according to his son. I don't think there's any other logs. I mean, that would be an excellent question for Dave Bellarts, who I certainly probably has the most information out there on his father that anybody has. And he could definitely answer that question. But I think from what I remember being told, it was basically just his style of writing and his shorthand. I don't know if it was particular to that particular log or question. I don't have an answer for.
So Chris, did you actually answer my question?
Which one?
Are they going to retrieve the plane or not? Or are they going to do something else? Or do we know?
How do I answer this without spoiling? Trust me, I would definitely tell you if I could do it without being like spoilerific on who might be involved in it. They want to keep that under wraps just because they're trying to, you know, full transparency. They're trying to get funding for a documentary film crew to go out there and to assist them with distribution. They have to keep a lot of like who's involved close to the chest and kind of like what specific tactics they're going to take to try to identify the aircraft out there and everything. That would be all filmed and everybody will see that, you know, once the documentary hits, if they get their funding, frankly. That's kind of where we're at.
So for the audience's benefit, there are a few things that make this compelling. Number one, the fact that everybody understands that there is a plane there that is about the size of the Electra. I understood at some point there were some pieces of evidence that may or may not have panned out. There was a suitcase or a briefcase inside that may or may not have had Putnam's initials. Can you talk about that? Is that true?
No, I don't. Honestly, I don't really think that that's true. And I don't think Bill thinks it's true either. That was sort of like, that was kind of like a local rumor that started when it came to, you know, a lot of the stuff that was built up around this wreck site out there in Buka way back when it was a lot more visible and all that. And they had claimed for a while, for those who may not know, that there was the details were so specific that it was Earhart, that there was actually even luggage in there that was monogrammed with, I've heard, either AE's initials or GP's initials. And, you know, they found a bunch of stuff in there. The truth is, we don't know. And the idea that, you know, that was ever leaned on is more than just rumor and innuendo and just stuff to really sort of like make the theory more fantastical is kind of beyond me. I mean, I just know with what Bill has specifically spoke to and based off of the video and the interviews and the footage I've seen of Buka 1 and Buka 2, I can tell you that it's much more technical. And that stuff that you hear about, you know, I wouldn't have any validity to it at all, to be honest with you.
Okay. So next question is the also pertaining to Buka. Nobody's disputing that there was a local who saw a plane crash. I thought originally people were saying that that actually happened on July 2nd or July 3rd, probably local time, 1937. But now that's in question. It's just sort of circa that time. Is that, can you speak more to that?
I couldn't speak as much to it as Bill could speak to that. From what I understand, there was a witness, that lone witness that was there that saw the whole thing, right? And he, as Bill described, it, I think he said he thought it was like the second coming or something. He didn't know what it was because they were in an area that they didn't see those types of aircraft. At least the children didn't. He runs off and he tells everybody and nobody believes him. You know, he grows up and they basically, you know, years and years and years later, they're free diving for something down there and they happen upon this wreck. And it's like, just like this now elder said, you know, way back when he was a kid. And so that's all I know. That's the story that I know. And as I've come to know it, I feel that to be pretty accurate. And that's based off of sort of a lot of the villagers that have handed down the stories of the aircraft. Now, you know, we don't know for sure if it's true. You know, we have record of the kid and everything. So like they, you know, they've done some due diligence on that to prove that story.
I'm not disputing the story. I'm questioning whether how proximate in time that was to July 1937.
It fits. It's right in that time frame of that morning or that nighttime. It was nighttime in Buka, like wee hours of the morning in Buka. And by the time that's sort of one of the other things that Bill posits is like the time of day. That's why they were on different frequencies. That's why they couldn't communicate, because she was on her nighttime and they were on their daytime. And again, it's like he's got sort of reasons for it. But as far as I'm aware, right in that July 2nd, July 3rd morning timeline, it fits according to the theory.
Make the case then, Chris, please, with what you can tell us that this is true.
That the story is true, or that the...
I don't know, that this is the Electra.
Oh, make the case that this is the Electra?
Please.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's so hard to do without saying certain things. They've deployed technology out during Buka 2 that helped solidify and verify a lot of the original things that Bill was saying about the exact dimensions of the aircraft, the original features of the aircraft. Some of it is diminished.
Well, I read Bill's book. I know he said that it was twin-tailed, twin-engined, Ford cockpit with possible landing lights under the nose. That brings to mind only two families of aircraft to me, the Beech 18 series and the Lockheed Electra series. So The main way to differentiate those would be...
Well, with Earhart's, it's certain things like the loop antenna that was on top. You know, that was observed at the site. It's probably long crushed and gone now. I mean, it's when you look at the wreck site now, it's kind of hard to tell really what you're looking at. But I've talked to everybody who's put hands on it down there, who's investigated it, and they're all, you know, they've all told me it's absolutely, you know, genuine what Bill says it is. Everything matches. It's like the dead body syndrome. There's a murder victim or something, and it's like miles away. You're going to let that stop you from, you know, be like, no, it's too far away. No, of course not.
We're with you.
And there's this plane at Buka that happens to match all these characteristics, and all this stuff's unfolding behind the scenes. And everybody says that he's crazy. I mean, what are the odds? 100 million to 1 at that point you're going to. So it's either Earhart and Noonan, or you have to explain something that's 100 million to 1, 100 million to 1 at that point in that time. It's unimaginable, the odds that he's wrong on this. And if he strikes out and it's not Earhart and Noonan, it's going to be something bigger than that. That's all I can really tell you. It's like, that's all I can tell you. Like, I wish I could just sort of like go into it, but it's going to be bigger. I mean, like, we always thought that, like, oh, it's either going to be the Holy Grail, or he's going to be able to tell the story of whoever was flying that aircraft. Like, the, and that's going to be impersonal and an intimate thing for him. And it's a great thing. Now, it's going to either be the Holy Grail, or it's going to be like, holy shit, when we find out what potentially is there if it's not Earhart and Noonan.
Okay.
So those odds, to me, I'll take them all day, every day right now, just knowing what I know. I'm all in on that. I want him to have his answer.
You want to know.
I want to know. And if he's wrong, he's wrong. He's more than willing to be like, I'm wrong, I'm sorry. But he gambled all in with his own money. Like, who does that? It's sort of like heartbreaking, you know, because this guy's getting just his ass beat in public sometimes on stuff. And it's like, he's the sweetest guy you'll ever meet. And he's just like, hey, like, you know, he's you never hear him trash talk anybody. Like, that's so refreshing. And I think that is what ultimately has brought everybody to Buka 3. And it's going to be incredible. And I can't wait for people to see it. I can't wait for it to be announced. I can't wait for people for it to become public. I want it more than anybody else.
You think we'll have something definitive within the next year?
I really think so. I really think so. Because it's not only Buka that's, you know, we're just talking about one. I mean, you know, there's a possibility of sure that he could be wrong. I mean, freely, like, you know, it could be something else. But I mean, the odds are too high. But that doesn't discredit or discount, you know, what people are looking into for a lot of other theories that are out there. So I say, you know, again, until he does what I hypothesize he'll do, we have nothing. If he strikes out, we have to have sort of, you know, there have to be contingencies in place for like, okay, well, where's the investigation go next, you know? And that's where we'd go.
So basically what we're saying here is we believe that Bill believes that he knows exactly what he's got here. Now, what all of us have talked about offline a little bit,
yeah,
and you've alluded to on the podcast before, 2017, the Jaliwit photo doc. I know Sean loves this one. Go for it, buddy.
All right. So here it is in a nutshell.
Okay.
If those two are not Earhart and Noonan, who could they possibly be? Who's in the photo?
I have no idea. I agree with you. It's compelling. That's why I despite being arguing as passionately as you just heard me argue about Buka, like, I think, as I said, the last thing I said was it shouldn't discredit any other investigations. And I should say that it's not impossible that two theories might explain the ultimate fate regarding what happened to Earhart and Noonan. It's not out of the realm of possibility that two camps have it right, or have a portion of the story right. I certainly agree. Les Kinney's arguments are valid. They're legitimate. There's nobody on the face of the earth that knows more about Earhart than Les Kinney does. You have to lend a lot of weight. You know, you have to lend a lot of credibility to what he's saying. And he's saying absolutely, unequivocally, they were there. That's what happened. He knows like he knows. And just that argument on its face, knowing him as I know him, the limited amount that I know him, I would say that I would hold a lot of weight. I think he's very right that it's almost impossible. Who else could that be besides Earhart and Noonan? And that Noonan, and again, we talked to everybody off the record, on the record, that was involved in Lost Evidence. That image of Noonan is stunning. It looks really good. It looks like it could be him. And so I say all in on that. I mean, I know it's cop-out answers, but I mean, I'm a fan of this whole investigation. So like, I want to hear it all with the people involved in some of these theories. Like, why not? Again, we have nothing. We have nothing in this case still. So it's all relevant. No one's ever going to be able to convince me that it's not.
Okay. So we have Buka. We know we have a plane, and in theory, we can raise that plane and look at it, or there are other ways of definitively proving. Is there a way to definitively prove Japanese capture or disprove?
That's tough. The eyewitness testimony is so heavy. I feel like in any other case, it almost would be proven. You know, if you go on circumstantial evidence and you go on like eyewitness testimony, it's got a lot of both. I think if it's going to be proven, it's going to be probably proven in like the archives, kind of like along the lines of what Kenny's doing. I don't have any delusions of grandeur of them going out there and digging up bodies in Saipan and everything. I mean, it's possible, certainly, but I would imagine that they're going to prove that in the archives. There's going to be some kind of documentation that's going to come forth that's going to like blow the whole thing open, and it's going to unequivocally prove that she was in the Marshall Islands or in Saipan or in both, or who knows. I'll be very honest with you. I think part of the bias I have against Japanese capture is a selfish one. It's the most horrible outcome that you can possibly imagine for Earhart and Noonan. Now, the reason why it should be investigated and they should never stop looking into it is because it's the most horrible outcome that could have happened to them. We would owe them a debt of gratitude for being early, you know, victims of World War II, potentially, you know, patriots, you know, who knows what they, maybe Earhart did get kicked into a shallow grave. Maybe they did try to gut her for information. Maybe they did try to turn her into Tokyo Rose. Maybe they did try to use her as propaganda, and maybe she just told them to go stick it. And she died for that. I mean, who knows? I'm speculating, but that's sort of what the theory implies. I have bias against it. I don't know how you definitively prove it, but I think archives are it. The only way you really disprove like Japanese capture specifically, I think, is if you find her in the ocean. If you find her 18,000 feet down, 200 miles ish around somewhere around Howland Island, then she wasn't in Japanese custody. It was just one big, you know, misunderstanding. But if you find it in Buka, or if you factor in the spy plane idea, or if you know, and that starts to then Bolam starts to crawl into the cave and it starts to become some really insane thing. But even if you left that out of it, it's hard to disprove it unless they find him in the ocean. Then it's like, well, that's just basically what happened. Occam's razor rules all.
Flipping it the other way, and I can hear Sean's eyes rolling right now because we're going to have to get there. Let's just get it over with. So flipping it the other way, if Japanese capture doesn't happen, how do we support Bolam?
You don't. It goes hand in hand. I've always said that. Bolam is a crazy idea. It's a crazy idea. I mean, on the face of it, it really is. But Japanese capture is a crazy idea on the face of it. And here's the argument I've always made. And I've made it like in our group before. And I think I've made it on the show too. If you're going to buy the idea that Earhart and Noonan were captured by the Japanese and spent X amount of years in custody and died or didn't, you know, let's say you're going to support the idea that they died, either by whether she died in Garapan prison or she gets kicked into a grave or some other outcome. Right? That's a pretty fantastic idea on its face, even if you leave Bolam out. The only difference between Bolam and really the ending of Japanese capture, and I've said this many times, is one, she lives, or one, she dies. That's basically it. So the theory as it goes is that she's repatriated and that they're one and the same. I happen to think, after sort of everything that I have been exposed to, all the people I've talked to, is it possible? Sure. I think it's much more compelling. I think it's much more likely that they were not one and the same, that Bolam was more of a, had more of an intimate involvement in the outcome of Earhart's life, or maybe she just was in the know, or maybe Bolam was married to an MI6 agent and valued other areas of her life and privacy and didn't want to be exposed for something she knew there, and it had nothing to do with Earhart. It's compelling. This woman knew something. I'm firmly in agreement that she ultimately knew the end of Earhart's life, knew what happened, and was maybe in the very small circle of people who actually did know. Maybe you could look at that as her being part of a spy mission, that her and Earhart were maybe together in a mission that went bad and Earhart lost her life and she was sent back. And then comes Joe Jervis and, you know the history, so we don't have to go into that. But, you know, I don't know, but I would tell you that Bolam is a crazy idea on the face, but I've seen the court records. You know, the fingerprint stuff is just too weird. The payout is too odd. Everything that happened is too weird. The people that knew her, it's just too weird. You know, I've talked to big icons of aviation that, you know, were in the know and knew all these people that were involved in, you know, these theories and this stuff. And they all say the same thing. A lot of Earhart's Zonta, a lot of her, the 99s, a lot of, you know, the people that knew her closest, knew her best, all said that there was something wrong with that woman. There was something weird with that woman. And to me, that's enough. That's compelling enough to find out who was Irene Bolam. Was she Earhart? Probably not. But would I be like stunned if we found out tomorrow that she was Earhart? No, I wouldn't be at all.
You mentioned the court case, and I know that there was the contention that she was offered a sum of money, a large sum of money, if she would just give up her prints. Do we know that definitively?
We do now.
If you read Tiger's website, they will say that they reviewed the court records and there was no mention of that. Now, that doesn't, just because there's no mention of it doesn't mean it didn't actually happen.
Yeah.
You could talk about that.
I've read some of the depositions. I've read some of the court records. There have been court records just been unsealed that were previously sealed that prove that she was offered $10 million for the lawsuit. And I've seen them and I'm in the middle of trying to retrieve them. So I was kind of getting hyped up by, you know, some folks in New York about like, hey, we might be able to get you this stuff. And so I'm excited about it. We're going to talk about it either way if we have them or not. But we know that they are, we know that they exist. And I've seen them and I can tell you that, yeah, it does show that she was offered a $10 million settlement, $10 million for one set of prints, and she turned it down flat.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What is the single best case you can make for Bolam? Who was she? If you had to put your chips on all or nothing, where are you putting your chips? Who was she?
Well, I know she was a 99 because we have photographic evidence of that, of her and Earhart running in the same circles and taking pictures together, and they knew each other quite well. I know that she knew Earhart early on. There was some kind of cloudy history, and there was a period of time where she sort of dropped off the radar. Like, we don't really know what happened to her. And what I will tell you is that Bolam's son saying specifically that when they had the memorial dinner for Bolam, the pictures that they used of Bolam, what was supposed to be his mother, was not her. So he has been on record multiple times in saying, I was raised by two different women. Like, there was another woman that raised me and I don't know much about her background. That's interesting. Now, it doesn't necessarily, does that mean she's Earhart? No, of course not. But I mean, like, that's compelling, right? And then she just sort of like drops off the radar and just pops up all of a sudden. And Joe Jervis kind of sees her and instantly recognizes her. Those images of her, there are some images that are not so great, but some of the forensic photo overlays and stuff are, to me, are compelling. And we talk a lot about it in the original season of Vanished, and Jen's got a lot of personal thoughts about forensic photo overlays, and she makes excellent points against Swindell's forensic study. Her son's testimony is probably the most compelling thing. The fact that we know she knew Earhart and these newly unsealed court records, we know that what Tiger knows or what Tiger states is just inaccurate.
So your contention, if I could put words in your mouth,
mm-hmm.
she was a figure in the circle, in the sphere of Earhart, but was most likely not Earhart herself.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow was mistaken for her. And I don't know how you get over that. That is plausible. There is a fair amount of latitude given to publishers, right? So for them to effectively win that case, you would think that there's a pretty high standard that would have to be met in order for that outcome, right?
Right.
So, which makes the actual Bolam / Earhart direct connection seem untenable. Right.
Yeah. It's difficult to ignore. I think she's just somebody that was involved. How deep that involvement runs is where the fun lies, I think, in investigating, like, you know, who was this woman? Was she number two? Is it possible? They talk about the spy theory and the spy planes all the time. And, you know, the multiple plane theory, again, some big heavyweights believe in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know who I'm talking about. You know, there's some heavyweight investigative research behind that. And, you know, it's possible that Bolam could have been the second pilot.
Okay, so going along with that, you know me. You know how much I love Noonan. The thing that gets lost in the shuffle here is Van Dusen.
Mm-hmm.
This is another case where there's two people supposedly with the same name. The original Van Dusen from Pan Am with a really striking background, very similar to Fred's.
Mm-hmm.
And the later Van Dusen who Bobby Myers was like, that's Fred Noonan. Are we thinking second group? Are we thinking same kind of thing with Bolam?
I don't know. You know, the Noonan thing is weird. That's a tough one because nobody really knows what became of Noonan.
Right.
The only theory, well, I should take that back. There's a couple of theories that posit. Castaway posits that he likely was injured on the landing and he never, in fact, maybe never made it out of the plane. We don't know. We don't know for sure, but that's likely. If they had a rough landing like that, I mean, it's possible that he could have gotten fatally injured on the plane. And then, of course, Japanese capture states that he might have been executed, which is, again, horrific. We don't know. But, you know, as far as like being repatriated or, you know, coming back with Earhart or at another time than Earhart, I don't know. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot on Noonan. And I think that's really one of the most tragic parts of the whole story. And I think, you know, people like Nicholas and, you know, Burl Burlingame and people, you know, there's so many people that try to keep, you know, Noonan's legacy alive. And, you know, Nicholas does a fantastic job, Nicholas Augusta, of keeping Noonan's active, you know, his legacy alive. And, you know, we're starting to see that more. But unfortunately, I couldn't tell you what happens to Noonan because, frankly, nobody posits or even really thinks about what happens to Noonan in these scenarios. It's all Earhart and it shouldn't be.
Yeah, we definitely need a good book on Noonan. Maybe you should do that.
I'm not the guy exactly. For that.
I'm not either. Don't look at me. Tell me a little bit about the struggles of hosting a podcast.
It's largely a lot of fun. The podcasting platform, I should say, is, you know, a lot of fun. It gives everybody, you know, it gives everybody a chance to have a voice, which is awesome. I guess it was always part of the initial plan to like to do the podcast for Chasing Earhart because I wanted to be able to talk to as many people as I could. And I didn't want to have geographical limits. And so I thought, well, this just seemed the most logical way to do it. And, you know, it's a little hectic when you don't sort of, you know, when you're starting to structure interviews and, you know, I don't write out any of my questions. I just kind of go, you know, and I just have topics and bullet points that I like to make sure we hit. I do that with every guest and it's become easier over the years, but the actual show, the product itself, I guess, whatever you want to call it, Chasing Earhart, the brand, whatever it is. And, you know, what we've done with Vanish so far, you know, it opens you up for a lot of criticism in the market because it's, you know, you're putting yourself out there. That becomes difficult when you're sort of getting, you know, ripped to shreds in five different directions. And it's kind of tough because you're trying to hold it all together and, you know, to stay neutral. And, you know, that can be hard sometimes. I think that's shown on the show, especially on Vanish for sure. When I came back to do more episodes of the show, including, you know, this one, it's just for selfish reasons now. I just do it I just reach out to people and like, hey, I want to have you back on the show or I want to have you on for the first time. And it's kind of like just a much more casual conversation now. I think we've sort of earned that over the years, but yeah, it's not come without cost for sure. It's tough to host the show sometimes. It's tough to deal with all the fallout from the episodes and people that can't take criticism and do get hurt and do take this personally. Unfortunately, it's unfortunate and it's negative to the case. It's negative to what everybody's trying to, I think, ultimately achieve. That's been the hardest part of hosting it, is sort of being on the other end of all that shit, really. It's just a lot of stuff that drops down on you, you know, and can't please everybody. And we tried for years. We tried, and it's tough. And, you know, we were largely successful in certain areas, but there's other areas that we fall flat. And there's people to this day that are dream guests of mine that will never talk to me because they, for whatever reason, just, I don't know, think I'm this kind of like disgusting kind of, you know, in bed with certain people person or whatever. And it blows my mind. All I ever wanted to do was just host a show, talk to people about Earhart, bullshit about the topic, discuss the legacy, talk about theory and just have fun. I'm hoping that's what we're doing now, finally.
Well, like we said at the open, you're the only podcast I can think of that actually tries to go ahead and give every single theory equal time and to present them all without any kind of a bias. So you kind of answered
to my own detriment. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, you kind of answered my next question, which was going to be, do you have that dream person or has anybody just flat out said, hell with you, without naming names?
Mike Campbell is always right at the head of the pack. No, I'll say this publicly. Mike Campbell's my guy. If I could have one person on the show, I'm ready to go tomorrow. I've been asking for Mike Campbell for years and he, you know, he doesn't like me. I understand that, but he's been very gracious through email. It hasn't been the most pleasant all the time, but he was gracious enough to advise on our two-part series we did for Vanish. Like he looked at the structure. He looked at this, like at least the skeletal outline. I'm sure he didn't listen to the show, but he looked at it at least and said, yeah, you know, you're hitting some of the good points. You got some good people on. I think you'll do all right. you know, that made me feel good going into that theory, because I was skeptical, to be honest with you, if we'd be able to do it justice. And there was so much buildup to it. And everybody was talking about, this is it. This, again, the Japanese capture, they have that tagline. They love that tagline. This is the truth. It's the truth. And it's like, yeah, okay. But like, maybe not. I really thought if Mike Campbell would have come on that show and presented alongside Les Kenny and some of the other folks, you know, Rob Ellis and some of the other folks that were so generous with their time for that, I think it would have been great. And if Jen would have been able to have the opportunity to cross-examine Les Kenny, I think it would have been great. It could have really strengthened the argument, you know, that Japanese capture makes for what ultimately happened to Earhart and Noonan. You know, I think, again, Campbell would have been great in there, and I've always wanted him. That's my guy. I've got others too, but that's the one that's always asked about. Did you get Mike Campbell? Why haven't you gotten Mike Campbell? It's not for lack of trying. Maybe he'll hear this, and maybe he'll email me, and maybe he'll be upset, or maybe he'll finally decide to come on the show. We'll see. Probably not.
So where do you go from here?
We're in season 3 of Vanished right now. Right after this, I'm recording part 4 of Zodiac with Jen. We go forward together. That's the show. It's always been a duo. It's been her and I for Vanish for a long time. And I will take her as long as she's willing to do the show. She's, you know, obviously a rock star, and she's a huge part of what's made Vanish so successful. And so we will continue to do the show together, and we will have some fun experimentation with the show. We've got some really great cases we're going to be discussing, but I think I just go forward with Vanished, Chasing Earhart. You know, I don't know realistically how long that runs. There's a couple of people I want to have back on the show. I'm working to, if she can fit me into her schedule, she's very busy, but Sammy Morris is going to be coming back on the show pretty soon to talk with me. I love Sammy. I think she's incredible. You know, I'm hoping to get coax Lisa Cotham to come back onto the show. And I actually have never had Lisa Cotham come on Chasing Earhart and have a full-blown conversation with me. She took part in Vanished, of course. So I'd love to have Lisa on the show, you know. So I've got some, you know, some, I guess, some bucket list guests before the show kicks the bucket officially. And there's just nobody else for us to talk to, or nobody else that's willing to talk with us. And once you get to that point, you have to stop. So I would imagine Chasing Earhart's coming to an end at some point sooner than later, and Vanish will just continue on as long as we're able to do the show and as long as the audience is there.
Let me plug your book, Rabbit Hole.
Yes.
And full disclosure, again, I wrote the afterword for Japanese Capture.
Yes, you did. A great afterword too for Japanese Capture. A great retrospective. You really surmised it great. You did a good job.
You mentioned earlier there might be some news coming out regarding Buka.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other news expected from any other camps that might cause you to pick up your microphone, as it were?
Oh yeah. Anytime there's any kind of Earhart news, that's kind of the beauty of it. We can just revisit the show. We can cover it. You know, whoever's willing to come on and talk with me, you know, the floor is always open. I am willing to hear out anyone. I'm willing to even, you know, reach out and mend fences and have people on the show that, you know, we've had falling out with or whatever the case is. I'm, you know, I want the show to be really just an archive. That's all I've ever wanted. So I think we'll do okay.
That does lead me to another question I had earlier that I almost forgot about. In some of the earlier episodes of Chasing Earhart, you talked about the documentary. How's that going? The documentary you're doing for Earhart.
Yeah. So as far as I'm concerned, we're done with the original concept. We have about probably 40 hours of footage, a lot of B-roll, a lot of that stuff. We've got, I don't know, almost 80 people filmed. We gave the archive to a couple of developers. They loved what they saw. If they get distribution for like Buka 3 and they get a documentary film crew to go out there and film it, you know, they might use some of our archival footage and kind of mix that in. So the documentary sits in archives. I have access to it. You know, it's there. I can go back and I, you know, sometimes I'll watch some of the footage, and it's wonderful. You know, we have footage with people that, you know, we don't have contact with anymore, either by them passing away or by them, there's, you know, been some kind of falling out or misunderstanding or whatever. And that kind of, it kind of makes me sad, you know, when I think about that, because it was sort of like a really great aspiring deal that I tried to start out and do. And now I talk about this case being full of like bitterness and anger and a lot of pain and a lot of like finger pointing and a lot of accusations. And it just gets really downright nasty. And it's the truth. Again, I've sort of always been a target for it. Maybe that's because we opted to stay as neutral as we did, as long as we did. And, you know, even now, like I'm a fan of all these theories. I mean, no one's ever going to be able to break me on that. I just am. I want the case to be solved, and I don't care who solves it. I really don't care. If Snavely's proven flat wrong and she crashed in the ocean, great. I mean, not great in the sense of I want to know. The world needs to know. I'm tired of this shit. Like, I'm over it. I don't want to do this show anymore talking about all this theory. Like, I want to know. So that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited about sort of what's unfolding behind the scenes in Buka right now, potentially. It's going to drop everything on its head. No one's more excited about it than I am.
Do you have a favorite book, either fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, I am Amelia Earhart. Brad's book is wonderful. You know, that's the legacy right there. I mean, I think Susan Butler's book is incredible. The amount of time that it took for her to immerse herself into that story and to research it and to ingrain herself in that is great. Yeah, that's a tough answer because there's so many great ones. But I would say, like, probably I Am Amelia Earhart by Brad Meltzer is my favorite book. You know, East of the Dawn's probably right behind it. God, I'm missing so many other ones. There's so many authors we've had on the show. Everybody's written such great books about her. Everybody's got such unique perspective and unique presentations to it. So if I had to pick two, one children's and one biographical, would be those two.
Excellent. Sean?
Are there any books about Noonan?
Not that I'm aware. I was in contact with a very sweet person. Her name is Jackie Ferrari. And for a long time, Jackie Ferrari, and I don't know much about her, so I won't talk too long on her. I'll just tell you that for a long time, Jackie Ferrari was the go-to source worldwide for Noonan. She was it. And there's not a lot of people that know about Jackie Ferrari, and it's kind of unfortunate because she's has done a lot of amazing work, and she was very kind. I tried to reach out to her. I tried to get her to come on the show, and she just kind of like turned that page now, so she doesn't want to really do it anymore. But Jackie Ferrari, you know, probably would have written an amazing book, and I think if anybody could have written a book on Noonan, it probably would have been her. A close second is probably Nicholas Augusta, who is, of course, a huge champion of Noonan, and God bless him for that, because, you know, he gets forgotten, frankly.
Yeah, because I know years ago we'd been talking and you'd said there was one in the works, but
never materialized. Yeah, I would love it if somebody wrote a book on Noonan. I think there's enough material there. I mean, I think you could certainly do it. And I think that would be a book I would want to read. You know, you follow Noonan all the way up from Noonan's POV as much as you can, all the way up into the world flight, and even, you know, interacting in the world flight, and, you know, that final footage of him getting into the flight with Earhart, and potentially the Jaluit dock photo later, you know, the only photographic evidence of Noonan after the fact, July 2nd, 1937. Yeah, I would love to see a Noonan book. Somebody should do that. Somebody should.
Even without the Earhart side. I mean, he was a preeminent navigator of his day.
The guy wrote the book, literally.
Literally.
He wrote the book. That was, I mean, I argue it all the time. It's true. It's, you know, that's the guy. That's the guy that you want to have on that flight at that time in that state. That's who you want. I'm going with Noonan every time. Talking about like Vegas odds, like I'm rolling with Noonan. You know, I know there's a lot of talk of, you know, the role, the size he played in the ultimate ending of Crash and Sink, and maybe potentially some of the other ones as well. I'll take him every time. She was right. She had an inkling. She knew how to read people. And I think that they respected each other enough that they were going to complete it together one way or another. Again, it just makes everything so much more tragic.
Especially because he'd just gotten married. For me, Noonan is the one that makes Japanese capture work, because he knew that area.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He knew that area.
He did. He knew it well.
He would have flown to an area he knew.
That's a good point. And it's an often overlooked point. Yeah. I mean, he's the star of that Lost Evidence documentary, which, I mean, that was the best part of that documentary. It's like, that's, you know, I know they talk about Earhart, focuses on Earhart. It's Earhart, Earhart, Earhart. I understand that. But I love that it's Noonan. I love the irony of that. Man, can you imagine the irony of it being Noonan as the guy that ultimately cracked the case? You know, it was actually Noonan that was discovered there, and Earhart was just sort of an aside. You know, yeah, she was there too, of course, but Noonan was what cracked it. That's pretty cool. I loved how they ran with that. Noonan was an icon, obviously, you know, goes without saying.
So you stated earlier that you believe the Buka is the most likely outcome. And you also stated that there is room for other theories to factor into that. So if you could tell us and your audience what you think is the most likely outcome, not just Buka, but be a little more specific about what you think happened and what you think didn't happen.
That's actually a tough question. The way you framed it, it's kind of hard for me to answer. I would say, again, I mean, I think just because Buka is so interesting, I think that needs to be investigated. I think Jen talks about in the show, like, you know, the idea that the Itasca radio logs and the call logs are like the last text messages in like a domestic violence murder or like a modern day murder case, something like that. That tells us all. And Tom Detweiler talks about it being the sum of a lot of little things that went wrong. And that's usually what happens in these types of cases. You know, it's not just like one huge thing that like makes a huge difference. It's the sum of a lot of little things. Knowing what I know and knowing what history tells us, reading through the call logs and really just hearing Earhart's voice in my head and listening to Bellart's testimony talk about how she was screaming at the end. It wasn't a whistle, it was a scream. All of that points to the fact that she just fell short and ran out of gas and maybe just had a really bad day and it didn't work out. Again, that's a huge amount of evidence to ignore, particularly when no one's ever been able to put anything forward to dispute that, frankly. I mean, I'm talking about like hardcore, like legitimate evidence now. Let's be real honest with each other about like what legitimate evidence would be. I'm not talking about speculation. I'm not talking about eyewitness testimony. I'm talking about physical proof of what happened. I feel like since nobody's been able to come up with that, the only physical proof that we have of what happened are those call logs and are of the testimony of the people that were there that day that will tell you unequivocally that Earhart sounded like she was screaming bloody murder almost at the end. Regardless of what we think might have happened, whether or not she was in Buka, maybe that was the point she was struck by lightning. Maybe that was when she was getting shot down by the Japanese and she was in a total different area. Maybe they were pre-recorded calls. I mean, you can go as crazy as you want. But officially speaking, whoever proves that Earhart ... has to disprove crash and sink. And the only way to do that, again, is finding the plane or something in the archives or something specific that relates and correlates to like physical proof of something else. You know, I think what probably happened is that Earhart and Noonan maybe ran out of fuel and ended up in the ocean. But again, I mean, that Buka thing is hard to ignore. And if Bill's right, how do you explain that? I certainly don't know. I think that would stun a lot of people. So I think it's either crash and sink or it's Buka. I think it's possible that you talk about like theories kind of coming together and potentially telling a story, you know, without getting into a lot of the details of the reasoning behind sort of the additional reasoning behind the trip out to Buka for Buka 3. I will tell you there are certain theories that will connect closer together than you might think. And I'm only saying that because I've spoken to the people who are doing the work. I'm not saying it because I'm just speculating and throwing stuff out. I happen to know based off the people that are involved and what's coming up soon. Japanese capture, Buka, maybe Bolam. Some of that maybe tells a story, a big overarching story that is a larger picture. I don't have details of how that possibly could be, but I think all those details, I think that'll be the fun in sort of unraveling that story once they find something, one thing, you know, that's definitive. And until then, got to go with the call logs, man. Got to go with Bellarts. Check out Buka. Don't let that go. But you got to look at what Bellarts is saying. You got to look at Earhart's testimony, what Earhart's saying. That carries a lot of weight with me.
Well, at the risk of going a little deeper, and pun intended, we all know that Nauticos and others have been out and looked at the bottom of the ocean. I read a statistic that they have searched an area the size of Connecticut.
Right.
So how do you explain that? Just unlucky or?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the area is not the size of Connecticut. The area is roughly the size of Texas, based off a lot of the theory. That's a piece of that. I mean, it's a massive, monstrous area, and everybody's got a radically different section of where they think Earhart and Noonan ultimately ended up. I'll tell you what, the pancake landing, the idea that Earhart notes we're dropping to 1,000 feet. Why would she do this? Well, maybe because she's trying to put the plane down on the water as gingerly as possible because she thinks that the plane will float. And it would, because we had a lot of people that worked on the aircraft that have testified on record that have said things like that plane would have been a ping pong ball with wings. It would have floated indefinitely, especially with the fuel tanks, the empty fuel tanks, if you're buying that she just ran out of fuel. But if she's not able to put the plane down gingerly enough and that plane gets pierced and those fuel tanks fill up, then she's going to sink immediately. And it's possible that the currents in that area, currents that they weren't really familiar with, could have carried that plane to God knows where. And we don't know specifically in what direction she was 200-ish miles out. 200 miles is a long way. And if you're going around a circumference of an island in a square mileage, that's a lot. At $3 or $4 million a day, that's a very expensive search. I think for crash and sink to ultimately prove and pull up the plane, maybe, which I would absolutely go giddy over if that was the case, they're going to have somebody with very deep pockets, like a Jeff Bezos type of guy. We know Jeff Bezos is an Earhart fan. We know that he brought her goggles up to the International Space Station and all that publicity stunt. And when he had Wally Funk go with him, like, we know that he's ingrained in the Earhart story. Someone's in that guy's ear. I can guarantee you that. And I can tell you that in the next year, it's a strong possibility that Bezos throws his hat into the ring and they end up funding a ridiculous Earhart expedition out to areas off the coast of Howland and Baker and some of the areas that Ballard wanted to search initially. And you can bet that with that kind of funding, they're going to find it. If it's there, they'll find it. And at that point, we'll have an answer. And I'm hoping in that first year or so, or in the next year as well, we'll have something at Buka. And we'll know in the next year definitively. If you can rule out Buka, if you can't find the plane 18,000 feet down somewhere near Howland, it's got to be Castaway. It's got to be Japanese capture. It's got to be one of those other ones. It's got to be Papua New Guinea, maybe East New Britain, maybe one of these other ones that are kind of floating around that, you know, have been very quiet for a while. I don't know, but I feel like you can eliminate two of those really big theories. And now you're down to three, potentially. I don't know, four. I don't, it just depends on kind of how the story unfolds from that point forward. I have no idea.
That kind of brings me to a question I've been meaning to ask, and I've heard you ask before, so it's fun to turn the tables a little bit. Do you think that we will ever actually know the truth of what happened?
Yeah, we're going to know. I feel it in my bones. We're going to know, and we're going to know soon. There's too many great investigations going on right now. There's too much crazy shit that's being uncovered. This Earhart case, I can tell you without hesitation for people who are going to be listening to this that think that this Earhart case is died out or it's not being worked on. It's more aggressive now than it ever has been. It's just quiet. The Earhart case has a sort of this interesting ability to explode just out of the blue with a new juggernaut piece of information supporting one theory or the next. And I think you're going to see multiple instances of that in the next year, and it's going to go in wildly different directions, and it might intermingle, and it's going to get exciting. The only way to do this is to eliminate stuff. You got to get out there to Buka. You got to rule that out. You've got to deal with what he's putting forward. It's not even a question anymore. They can get out there and rule that out. Let's say we throw out Buka. Buka's out. Well, that's a huge piece of the puzzle that we can eliminate. Now you can sort of start focusing some of that investigative stuff maybe back onto Japanese capture. Maybe put some of those resources into finding out who Bolam was. I know that's my personal thing. There's not a lot of people that sort of ride with me on that, and that's fine. But there's a lot of interesting stories that you can investigate in the overall Earhart, let's say, legacy that are really very cool and interesting and compelling, and ones that haven't had the spotlight shown on them before. I think you'll start seeing a lot more of that. So I'm optimistic that we find out. And not only that, but we find out sooner than you might think.
You mentioned Tigar.
Mm-hmm.
If you're making the case for that, tell us what your argument would be for that.
For Castaway, I think the story works. If you're going to buy the idea that she could have gone to the Marshall Islands, you have to buy the idea that she could have gone to Niku. It's less than half the distance. On the face of that, can't argue that. If you're going to buy that she got to the Marshall Islands or to Buka or there was some crazy other story, then 400 miles away is not so bad. It's compelling in that aspect. It makes sense that they would have happened on that line. Knowing what I know about Noonan and knowing what I know about Earhart and their navigational abilities, they probably, it's a logistical sound decision that they would have continued north or south on that line. They would have maybe got lucky. The story of them putting the plane down on the reef and Earhart sending out post-loss radio signals in conjunction with high tide, low tide is very compelling. It's very compelling and it makes a lot of sense. And it's something that I think Earhart would have done. I think it's a decision she would have made. I think she would have had the smarts. I think she would have had the wherewithal to do that. I think she would have understood how her plane operated and would have understood that you had to do it at certain times. The post-loss radio signals match up compellingly well with those times. They've chased down the historical record of high tide, low tide. They've really gone to ground and done their research on this island and trying to build this compelling case. And you look at something like the Nicomororo bones, which I know is very controversial. You know, what Jantz did with that, you kind of have to respect. I mean, Jantz's name, again, carries an awful lot of weight with it. Like him or not, acknowledge him. The guy is one of the world's foremost authorities. And he says, without question, that those bones are hers or have a very high, let me rephrase that, they have a very high likelihood to be hers. I happen to respect that opinion highly. I know that Rick Gillespie does not, he's one of those other ones that, you know, just doesn't like me. We've clashed. Rick, I will give him his due. He has done a lot of wonderful things for the case. He has kept Earhart's legacy alive. He's kept her name in the media. He's kept the story alive. He's kept the investigation into the disappearance alive. He's got a lot of bravado. He's very charismatic. You know, the guy knows what he's doing when it comes to all of that. And they've put in the effort and they've put in the research. And I think, you know, it's one of those things you sort of have to acknowledge when you look at like cases of circumstantial evidence or like an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence. You kind of have to make the case that Tiger has indeed made a circumstantial case that Earhart and Noonan ended up in Nicomororo. And I think the post-loss radio signals, the Nicomororo bones, the Seven Sight, a lot of the stuff they've done over the years, I think it just adds up. It makes it very interesting. But unfortunately, you know, sometimes, you know, you're just wrong. And I don't know for sure if they're wrong. I have no idea, frankly. I just know that I watched that documentary like everybody else. And I'm privy to certain conversations behind the scenes. That island has been investigated to the hill. You know, it's been, I hate to use this term, but just for lack of a better one, it's been done to death. And we need to investigate or invest some of those resources into some of these other theories at this point. Let some other people get in on some of this investigation and try to prove some of their stuff right. So that theory is compelling from the basis of circumstantial evidence, but I just feel like it's been investigated heavily enough. We would probably have found something definitive by now if we were going to find anything definitive at all. That's just sort of where I stand on it. That series that we did for Vanished and that particular two-part series we did, I think it was like 8 or 9 hours or something like that, investigation into to Nicomororo and having everybody who's anybody in that case testify on the show and come on the show, they had a really great opportunity to present themselves. And whether or not they were successful in that, I mean, that's up to the listening audience. But I feel like Jen did some of her finest work in that two-part episode. And you sort of see why she was brought into the show is because she went to ground on the investigative side and just like tore through a lot of these guys. And it was ugly. And it was, especially when you consider what we kind of endured behind the scenes with that. So that's a whole nother rant, but you know, that's a very long-winded answer. And I apologize, Sean, but that's basically, I just feel like, you know, the compellingness of it is really is post-lost. It's the bones. It's the circumstantial evidence. I mean, that's what I would push. That's what I did push. And unfortunately, it didn't work out so well for us, I think, in that series. You know, I don't think we're able to slam dunk it with Nicomororo. And on the face, it certainly looks like you could.
There's kind of a dichotomy in how you find Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
Internet articles and the documentaries, they're all one direction.
Mm-hmm.
And then the majority of the books go towards another theory. Do you have any thoughts on why that is? I mean, you can probably fact check me on that, but it seems like most of the books will go towards Japanese capture, but most of the online goes towards Niku. Do you have any thoughts on to why that might be, or is this something we're going to end up cutting?
I know that TV is a much more fantastical sell, you know, and their TV is all about what's going to get eyes on the screen, you know, what's going to be the most compelling. I've been in so many meetings where I've talked to people and they said, okay, sell us. And they love the passion. They love, you know, what we're putting together, but they want more. And I feel like they want it to be more fantastical all the time. Again, I mean, Lost Evidence, I think, was a perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at like, if you can find it even, if you look at the trailers for Lost Evidence, and then you look at like the trailer, which I think you can find on Disney Plus for Expedition Amelia, they're epic takes on the case. Television has become so jaded on Earhart now because they choose to go all in and enticing and, you know, crazy conspiracy theories, you know, that people love that. It just puts eyes on screen. Facts. I mean, it just is what it is. Books will be more investigative, you know, and they'll play the long game more. And, you know, I don't know that I would agree that all there's more Japanese capture books. There's certainly a lot of them, certainly some of the best books. I mean, I totally spaced on Mike Campbell's book earlier when you asked me about, you know, some of my favorite books. Like Mike Campbell's book is one of the best books ever written on Earhart. You know, I think Les Kinney does have a book coming out, or he's working on one. I think that will certainly be among the best ever written on Earhart. You know, there's a lot of books, like there's a lot of children's books, a lot of legacy books, there's a lot more, I think, on that side than you might think. There's a lot of fantastical stories and like fiction being written about Earhart, with Earhart as a character in it now. She's all over comic books and graphic novels and, you know, just all kinds of really great stuff. And I think that's really kind of fun. You can walk any direction you want. But TV, it's got to be very specific. It's got to be short, tight, to the point, concise. They love cliffhangers. There's been so many documentaries that like they strike out. You know, Lost Evidence was kind of a big letdown in that aspect, because they get all the way, they build all this up and they don't find anything. And that's got to be heartbreaking for the people that are investigating it. Books are more, I think books are more long game, and television is more like what's going to pop right now. And of course, everybody wants the plane. So if they can produce the plane, that's what everybody wants. They think it's going to be some kind of incredible find, you know, and it is.
Lost Evidence, they also had the airplane pieces that they recovered.
They did. I mean, Dick Spink is, don't even get me started. I love that guy. He probably feels awkward sometimes, like when I, because I, you know, I'm just a fan. I'm just a fan of his work and what he does. And that's a no nonsense, no bullshit, straight shooter, logical thinker that is talented in a multitude of areas. The guy's a jack of all trades. You know, he follows all that evidence, and he's just a fantastic guy. I'm such a fan of Dick Spink and Les Kinnean and everybody that was involved in Lost Evidence, really. I mean, it was, that's their investigation. I think it's pretty compelling and pretty amazing. And yeah, he did bring some really interesting, compelling evidence to the Hilt. And he actually showed us a lot of those pieces up against Linda Finch's Lockheed Electra in the Seattle Museum of Flight when we were there shooting for Buka. He came out and shot a segment with us. I mean, again, very generous with his time. And he showed us some of the parts that he found that you're speaking of. We actually put him up against Linda Finch's Electra, and we got some still shots and some video of that for the documentary. And that was really cool. That was a neat moment for me.
I'm Bry Kupfer. He's Sean Keats. And this has been Chasing Your Heart. Thank you.